Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Human nature of what sort it is? What are human beings made of? You ever hear that? What are little boys made of? What are little girls made of? What are human beings made of? We already determined that they're made of meat. If cannibalism is wrong, why did God make people out of meat? I like that joke. As we look into the opening chapters of Genesis, you realize the Torah is not particularly interested in arguing over the origin of species, to use Darwin's term. Instead, from the Torah's perspective, human life is a miracle from God. The creation of human beings was a deliberate act by God, and this gives human life dignity and purpose. Clement, the disciple of Peter, said it this way. He said, above all, he formed man, the most excellent of all his creatures, and truly great through the understanding that he gave him, to express the likeness of his own image. So this is like what we're talking about when we learn that man is, yes, he's an animal, but he's a sentient being and he has consciousness, right? And so that makes him specialer, right, than a blade of grass. But here's the problem with that course of that train of thought then. Is he more special than a dog? Because I have two dogs and both of them, I assure you, are sentient and conscious. They have, and capable of sin. Yes, free will. They have a free choice, which they exercise, right? So what's the difference between human beings and an animal? Isn't an animal also sentient and conscious, possessing consciousness? And the answer is surely yes. With increasing complexity, a biological life form seems to have increasing levels of complexity of perception and sentience and consciousness. So it's not a matter of separation like, oh, this is human and this is not human. Like we'd like to make a clean separation like we are the most important thing in the world. That's anthropocentrism, right? Human centrism. We're the only thing that thinks. We're the only thing that has language. We're the only thing that has emotions. All of these sort of thoughts that people used to say have been dispelled. You know, as science continues to make inroads in the study of biology, in the study of animals, you realize animals are really quite clever in their own way. And they do communicate and they do think and they do have emotions and they're pretty much aware of what's going on. I remember a story about one of the queens of England. I tried to look it up. But I couldn't find it. It was a queen of England back, say, in the 19th century or 18th century, and they brought a chimpanzee for her to see. And she was really disturbed by this, the chimpanzee. Why do you think she was so disturbed by the chimpanzee? Because it was so human. She would see the expressions on his face and it's the five digits and the opposable thumbs and every bit of it. It was like, whoa, that's just like a human being. That doesn't seem right. We shouldn't be like animals, but this is not what the scriptures say. The scriptures say we are animals. It says in Ecclesiastes, what happens to the sons of man happens to the beasts. As one dies, so does the other. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is fleeting. So according to the Bible, we are no different than animals. At least our physical bodies, I should say, are no different than animal bodies. Yes, we're a little bit more developed cognitively, not physically. I mean, who wants to wrestle a chimpanzee? The chimpanzee will win. You know, who can climb the tree faster? You know, it's like, there's all sorts of contests we could, you know, it's like, okay, forget about that. Let's play chess. You know? Right? So humans really have no advantage over animals on these sorts of levels. But we say in the morning prayers, we actually quote that verse in the morning prayers, if you start that early in the Siddur, there's a prayer that says, humans have no advantage over animals, for everything is fleeting. And then in Nusach Sfard, there's a caveat that's thrown in there. It says, only the pure soul remains, which will ultimately give a justification and an accounting to God. And so the Nusach Sfard Siddur felt like, you know what, people are going to misunderstand that when they read humans have no advantage over animals, and they're going to think, oh, see, we're just animals. And they'll forget that humans, there is one thing that's different, and that is that the human being contains a neshama, a soul. The soul. They would say spirit. The apostles always say spirit, but it doesn't matter. The language is, we can work on the language at another time. So when God made Adam, you know, Adam means man. So God made man. God made Adam. That's Adam, right? He made him out of the Adama, out of the earth, the Adam. I guess you could say, human, we're made of earth, earth man, earth creature. Yeah, because he took the earth, he took physical matter, right? But to animate the man, it says that he breathed into him. It says, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. This is the neshama. It's actually in a verbal form in this verse. He breathed into him the breath of life, and the man became a living being, right? So this is the idea that when man was created, God breathed a soul into him. As Clement says, his breath is in us. When he pleases, he will take it away from us. So human life, the human being exists in this constant tension between these two very different points of origin, like when we were learning about orders of separation of the heavens and the earth. We live in these, we're made of these two different things. On the one hand, we're this physical stuff of creation, of this biological system of blood vessels and bones and flesh and physicality. And on the other hand, we're like a vessel that contains a hot burning spark of the immortal and the ineffable, of the spiritual and the heavenly. So that's called a hybrid. We're a hybrid. We exist in two worlds simultaneously, the physical world and the spiritual world. We're the stuff of earth, where our days are these short days that are consumed with the common, ordinary things of life. And, you know, like, I got to get up, I got to brush my teeth, I got to eat, I got to get off to work, you know, whatever the situation, you know. And we can pretty much spend 70 years or more, if God's gracious to us, seeking food, shelter, prosperity, fleeing pain, and pursuing pleasure. Boom, that's a human life. You know, that's the physicality side of it. And for most people, that's the whole thing, right? If you don't have the revelation of Hashem, that's the whole thing. On the other hand, there's this supernatural spark within us, the supernatural side of being a human being. And this is why you kind of always have that yearning for the divine that I was talking about, that seems to be this instinctual, universal reflex. And we've already been talking about how our job then on earth is to cultivate that spiritual side of our nature and integrate it then into this world as we represent Hashem in this world. And the only way to do that is to contain elements of both, right? We are spiritual and physical simultaneously, spirit and flesh simultaneously. In fact, you could think of your body, your human body, and your brain, your thinker, as an earth suit, similar to the space suit that an astronaut wears. Why does an astronaut wear a space suit? Because he doesn't belong in space. If he went into space without the space suit, he would pop. He would freeze and pop simultaneously. It's quite dramatic. And then he'd also be lanced through with cosmic rays at the same time. So he'd be frozen, popped, and lanced through with radiation all at once. So the only way to get around that is to wear a space suit. And that's how he can experience outer space, right? Okay, the soul is in a sort of similar situation. The soul doesn't belong here. The soul is spiritual. It can't really function in the physical. I don't know what would happen to it, but it doesn't have the capacity to interact with the physical world, with physicality. And so the soul wears an earth suit, which is like the astronaut's space suit, but it happens to be your body. Now, the soul could have potentially interfaced with some other body, like your dog, but the soul is looking for a mind with sentience and consciousness which it can interact with and experience through. Why? Where was your soul before it was born? Before you were born, your soul existed, which means you existed before you were born, which is crazy. I mean, even before you were conceived, you existed. Where were you? You were with God. You were existing in heaven, wherever that is, in the spiritual places, wherever that is, as a spirit, you already existed. And then at some point, God says to you, I need you to do something for me. And you're like, whoa, anything, what? And God says to you, I need you to, would you be willing to put on an earth suit and live a human life? And this is a frightening prospect for the soul. But nevertheless, you volunteered for it. You said, okay, I'll do it. Why? I mean, why would you do that? You had everything going for you. You were already perfect. You're already with God. Well, I wouldn't say perfect. There was something incomplete. Something was missing. And that's the point. There's something missing that can only be obtained through a human life. And I'll explain this to you with the metaphor that I'm going to call the homeschooled child. The soul is like a homeschooled child. The child lacked nothing. Everything he needed to learn, he could learn from his mother. Safe, at home, secure, yes. But the mother knew that there were some things she could not provide for her homeschooled child, that the child would never develop into an independent, autonomous adult if he didn't at some point separate from her and go out into the world and experience the world and learn from others and interact with others at some point, right? So what did she do? She did a terrible thing from the soul's perspective. She sent the child to school. Oh. What happened to the child when we went to school? He faced all sorts of situations that he had never experienced before, never had any concept of before, and most of them were negative and unpleasant. The student didn't understand why he'd been sent to the school. He's like, why? I was so happy at home. You know, now I have to get up. I have to get on a bus. People are mean to me. I'm being insulted. They're taunting me, right? And then there's the temptations. There were temptations that he had never even conceived of at home, tempted by the things of the world and peer pressures. But also there's some positive things. You learn from people. You had role models like teachers and who gave him positive input. But through it all, through the bad and through the good and through passing tests and so forth, the child finally, he's like, the term is over, comes home. He comes home. It's not the same child that left. He's the same child, but something more as well. An individual in possession of a sense of himself, his own strengths and weaknesses, maybe for better, maybe for worse, you know. And with a realistic view and a frame of reference, a different kind of frame of reference, aspirations, dreams, I don't know, a new sense of self-confidence. Anyway, it's an analogy. It probably falls short. School probably doesn't really accomplish that. But for the soul, it does. The soul is going to school here in you with us. Because the soul, with Hashem, the soul lacks nothing. It lacks absolutely nothing, but in itself, it's not complete. because it doesn't have its own identity. It has no sense of separation from Hashem. And so God knows that the soul can never develop into a sentient, independent, autonomous consciousness if it doesn't enter into the world of physicality and limitation and experience the finite limitations of life on earth. So what does he do? He sends the soul into a physical body to be born into a human life. The soul is confused. It faces all these trials and temptations and humiliations and suffering. Oh, that's awful. Suffering is just awful. Souls never knew suffering before. This is horrible. Why does this hurt so much? I stubbed my toe. This is terrible. Why did God create toes? This is awful, right? And the soul is going through all these experiences in sorrow to experience loss. The soul never experienced loss. But now the soul is experiencing these horrible things, is seduced by various temptations in the world and passing tests or failing tests, whatever. Learning, experiencing, and more than that, merging with a human identity, this animal, and thereby lifting that animal to a spiritual level. This is an amazing thing. And that brings me to another analogy that I use for the soul. And this is the silly putty analogy. How many of you have ever used silly putty to lift ink off of a newspaper? Yeah, most people. Okay. All right, so it's just one of the things you do with silly putty. We used to get the Sunday newspaper, and you'd have full-color comics, whereas during the week, they were just black and white. But on Sunday, ooh, the comics were full-color, right? And so that's when you get out the silly putty, and you flatten the silly putty out on one frame of one of these full-color comics, and you lift it up, and it lifts the ink, and you've got the whole picture there, and then you can stretch it, and you know, it distorts the picture. It's a lot of fun. So that's what you do with silly putty. So the soul is like silly putty. The human being is like the comic. What the soul does, the physical body, the human body is like the Sunday newspaper. The soul comes and gets smooshed down into that physical body. It's smooshed right onto it. And then when the body dies, the soul gets lifted off. But look, it carries with it the image of the human being, of that whole experience of that lifetime is carried with the soul. And this is how you live after you die, thanks to your soul. If you just had to depend upon your animal side, you're done. You die, lights out, game over. But the soul goes on living after you're dead because it was alive before you were alive. Does that make sense? All right. This was God's idea. I'll make a mud ball and put a spirit in it. I'll make a meat robot and I'll put a spirit in it. This was God's idea. The angels thought, not a good idea. And so in the Torah it says, let us make man in our image and our likeness. He's talking to the angels. He says to the angels, let's make man spiritual. Let's put a spirit in him. Make him in our image and our likeness, and he'll rule over everything, all the creatures on the earth, all the fish and the birds. And so when God says this to the angels in Jewish legend now I'm leaving the Bible and I'm entering the world of Jewish legend. According to Jewish legend, the angels say, no, not a good idea, not a good plan. Here's what's going to happen. This guy, this human creation that you're making is going to do all sorts of sins. You're going to give him free will, and he's going to create, this is going to be a big problem. You don't want to do this. Do not do this. And plus, it's insulting to our dignity as spirits. I mean, you're going to take spiritual essence and mix it with mud? This is an insult. It's an insult. And so Hashem's going, yeah, you make a good point. You make a good point. But the whole time behind his back, he's making Adam. And so that's the Jewish legend. And so then the chief angel of his court who led this objection was an angel named Samael. Ooh. And this particular angel then led an insurrection in protest. And he descended into the created order. And just like a soul enters a body, he entered the body of the serpent. And this is why the serpent can talk. This is why the serpent can speak, because this spirit entered into the serpent to seduce the human beings and lead them on the wrong course and thwart the plan that human beings should be God's image in the world, that we should bear God's image in the world. This is the all in the world of Jewish legend that I'm telling you this, but you can see how it intersects with the biblical narrative, because what happened then, the serpent came to the man and the woman and tricked them. He tempted them, seduced them. And this story speaks to the problem with human beings, that there's just something wrong with us. There's something very... I mean, this story is here to answer the question of, why am I like this? Why do I try to do good, but then I do bad? How can I be reading the scriptures and all holy, and then I go out and I'm like, I'm distracted by some sensuality or some piece of gossip or some cruelty, you know, in my heart, you know, how can I be so like this split personality? Well, the split personality is actually a result of having an evil inclination and a good inclination. God created you with a good inclination and an evil inclination. And you might think, what kind of joke is this? Why did you give me an evil inclination? Just give me a good inclination. Why'd you give me you gave me an evil inclination, then you tell me don't be evil? How's that fair? But remember, he wanted to give you a choice. If he only gave you a good inclination, there's no choice there. You wouldn't have free choice if your only inclination was to do good all the time. That's not free choice. That's only one option. You need two options for a choice. So you need evil inclination and a good inclination, just like there needs to be good and evil in the world, right? So it turns out, actually, that if you look more closely at it, the evil inclination isn't all so bad. It's really there for your own self-preservation. If you didn't have an evil inclination, you wouldn't take care of yourself. You wouldn't feed yourself. You wouldn't. It's about survival. The evil inclination is there to protect you, to help you, to look out for number one. And number one is who you know who, right? You take care of yourself. It's your survival instinct. But something's wrong. Something's out of whack with your evil inclination and your good inclination. Something is broken in the human being, because somehow this self-instinct of self-preservation turns into selfishness, pure selfishness, that can result in all sorts of cruelty and self-indulgence and self-destructive behaviors and addictions and hatred and lust and abuse and you name it, all the evils of humanity. Something is really wrong here. And these things, of course, needless to say, these cut us off from Hashem and hamper us in our mission, actually make it impossible for our souls to fulfill their mission, the whole reason they were put into bodies in the first place. Instead of becoming something more than they were before, they become something worse, something soiled. And this is the problem. It says in the Torah, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. So that's called the evil inclination. The evil inclination is out of control in us. Jeremiah says, the heart is more deceitful than anything, desperately sick. Our hearts, the heart of a human being is desperately sick, he says. Who can understand it? And so the soul that enters this broken human being and then doesn't overcome this problem, fails its mission. It lives in a world of blindness, like blindfolded to truth, and then at the end of life returns soiled and dirtied and destroyed. It's like, wow, that was awful. and I was awful, and now I'm awful. I mean, that's what you just push that silly putty down on that newspaper and pick up that picture. What if the picture is obscene and horrible? You know, that's what we're talking about. It's called dirtying the soul, sullying the soul. Our master's solution was to say, look, I'm bringing you forgiveness of sins. I'm bringing you a cleansing, a spiritual cleansing. I'm going to wash your soul clean. And I'm going to give you teaching that's going to put you back on your mission. What is the mission? Here it is, that straight and narrow path. Choose life, the path that leads to life. How do you do that? Love others. If the evil inclination is out of control, what does the evil inclination want to do? The evil inclination is about me, selfishness. I love me, I love me, I love me, 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 me. Yeshua comes and says, love others as you love yourself. Take that self-love and apply that to others, and that puts you back on the mission. And this is what it means to be born again.